Glaciers have shaped much of the Earth. During the last ice age, about one-third of the Earth was covered by glaciers. Today, glaciers cover about 10% of the Earth's surface. They exist on every continent, and they store about 75% of the world's fresh water. Many people are concerned that rising global temperatures are melting many of them. So on this week's Please Explain, we're finding out more about glaciers, and joining us is Timothy T. Kreitz, glaciologist with the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Leonard.
And we invite our listeners, as always on these segments, to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So what is a glacier? What makes it different from a large patch of snow or ice?
So normally we think of glaciers as existing year-round. So they're ice masses that are essentially live through the summer. And they also deform under their own weight. So they actually change their shape and sculpt the landscape throughout the year, essentially.
So they're doing this constantly. They shape the landscape throughout history. New York would not look like New York if there hadn't been glaciers during the Ice Age.
Absolutely not. You can see a lot of remnant features in Central Park or Riverside Park or the other parks in the area.
And weren't the Bronx Hills once a mountain range?
Very long time ago, yes. But, I mean, during the Ice Ages, they were pretty similar to what they are now.
Do glaciers only exist on land?
Generally, we think of glaciers as being on land. There are large ice shelves that come out of Antarctica and a few in Greenland that are over the ocean, but they don't depress the land and they're not in contact with the land. There's also sea ice, which sometimes people confuse with glaciers and ice sheets, and that is a response to essentially winter coldness over the oceans.
So Arctic ice, that is really not glaciers.
No,
that's the same kind of ice, only on a much thicker level that we would get when the Hudson River has ice flows.
Exactly, that's a few meters thick, and it can pile up to maybe tens of meters thick. Yeah.
Do glaciers have to exist above the snow line?
No, they can actually flow below it. And so what you mean by snow line there, just to interpret for the listeners, is the snow line is kind of the average place of loss during the year. So it's where the temperature is roughly zero throughout the year. And below that, the glacier is losing volume. And above it, the yearly mass balance, what we call mass balance, is positive. So there's snow that exists all year round above the snow line.
And glaciers are made by snow, aren't they?
Yeah, they're accumulations of snow, and as the snow compresses, it forms something we call fern. And then as the bubbles compress, it forms essentially bubbly glacier ice that at great depth, the air dissolves into the ice matrix, and we get what's called a clath rate. So this is kind of a solid mixture of ice and air.
I'm assuming that the ice on the bottom, if this is a glacier that's been around a long time, can be thousands of years old.
Yes. The oldest ice we have right now is about 800,000 years old from near the base in Antarctica. And recently we've been looking at projects where we want really old ice. We call it oldest ice, which is about 1.5 million years old.
And so scientists go digging into the core to find out what was going on the Earth at any given time. Do we know when we go in 1,000 feet where we are in the history of the world?
Yeah, we do that a few different ways. We correlate that spatially to other what we call proxies of climate. We use modern climate, and we essentially read this book or the archive, what we call, in reverse. And then we correlate areas. So there are several cores in Greenland and several cores in Antarctica, and we make sure that they all match. And when we go deeper than that and they don't match, we know we're deeper.
And what do we discover when we get down there?
Well, what we'd like to know is how Earth's climate varied over the past 800,000 years or the past 1.5 million years. And there's a switch that happens around 800,000 years where we switch to kind of what we call the modern glacial, where we have 100,000-year cycles. And prior to that, we have 40,000-year cycles. Climate's much, much warmer. and the kind of ice ages are shorter. So as climate warms and we put more CO2 in the atmosphere, we'd like to know what were the conditions that were in the past and where are we headed in the future?
Well, there are climate change deniers who say that this, that what we're going through right now is just the same sort of thing that Earth has gone through throughout its history.
Well, in some ways they're correct. We're in a what we'd call an interglacial. The problem is that we have actually taken carbon dioxide from petroleum reservoirs, essentially, and put it in the atmosphere. So we're front-end loading a greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, so the atmosphere is going to warm.
Well, we assume that asteroids hit Earth, or an asteroid hit Earth at one point, leading to the demise of the dinosaurs and other forms of life. Is that something we can actually find when we go into the glaciers?
Well, asteroids or meteoroids, we can see. They actually pick them up on the surface of the Antarctic ice sheet. These are smaller meteorites. They're not dinosaur, say, impactors. We can certainly see old eruptions that correlate globally.
Ash from volcanoes?
Ash from volcanoes. So Pinatubo, for example, shows up in all the major ice cores, as well as old, for Greenland, the Icelandic volcanoes, of course, burp up ash, and then they show up in Greenland fairly readily.
My guest is Timothy T. Kreitz, C-R-E-Y-T-S. He's a glaciologist with the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. We're talking about glaciers on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite you to join the conversation. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org, or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Now, glaciers are made of fresh water. Are they the source of fresh water for the planet?
For the New York area, no. We generally receive most of our water resources, our snow from the winter that go into the reservoirs and fill them. For some areas in the Andes and Alaska, Pakistan, they are actually glacier-fed aquifers. So yes, they do.
They melt in the warmer months and then they feed the rivers and streams?
Yeah, and that's a big problem in terms of switching from glacier-fed rivers to snow-fed rivers. So we call those nival streams when they switch from glacier to snow. And those have very different characteristics in terms of melt. So it changes the growing season quite dramatically. So in terms of keeping glaciers around, the areas that have them and get their water resources from them is important to those areas.
Well, since glaciers seem to be melting at a quicker pace these days, is that changing growing seasons?
I'm going to start with the Arctic and the sea ice, because the average melt rate in Arctic sea ice is about an extra 6 days per year. And so when we see that extent of change that far north, we would expect smaller changes farther south. So, for example, in India. But yes, the short answer is yes, there's a few days of a change in the growing season.
Well, in the case of the Arctic melt, it is also changing the nature of sea life. The fish are moving to other areas, whales, et cetera. But that's salt water. We're talking about fresh water here.
That's right. So, and we're talking about human communities as well that are responding to these changes.
Now, why does a glacier move? Can you describe the process?
So a glacier moves much like silly putty moves. If I were to have an inclined plank and I had a big blob of silly putty, the silly putty would deform and move down that slope. And over very long times, glaciers behave the exact same way.
How fast do they move?
Well, the fastest rates are a few miles per year in Greenland, and they can be kind of on the order of a yard or so per day. That would be an average kind of rate for a regular glacier, so about 3 feet.
So I'm assuming that what's underneath them in Greenland is changing constantly, although we're not going to see it for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. So in Greenland, we actually expect, so through, say, 2100, meltwater put into the oceans is dominated by glaciers primarily. At about 2100, we lose most of the glaciers. Then, and at that time, the ice sheets really turn on, and most of the melt will be from Greenland, which we expect to take a few thousand years to melt, provided we understand what's going on.
You said that the oldest glacier is in Antarctica. How do we know that? Because it's the thickest?
Yeah, Antarctica is the thickest. The thickest ice in Antarctica is about 4 miles thick, and that's the thickest measured so far. And generally, thickness correlates to very low snow accumulation or snowfall rates, yeah.
Wasn't a woolly mammoth found in Siberia last spring? It's thought to be some 39,000 years old. Was it found in a glacier?
I believe it was found in permafrost. So that's
Now, what's the difference between permafrost? Because I was surprised to hear that, as I understand it, Siberia, despite the fact that it's very cold, doesn't have glaciers.
No, it's too dry for snowfall for the most part. So the ground freezes and the water table there freezes. And so that's really what permafrost is the groundwater freezing. And sometimes that's very close to the surface in kind of boggy areas that were formerly glaciated. But for the most part, permafrost is ground-based ice.
But we can assume that at one point, Siberia was covered by glaciers, as was pretty much all of the northern hemisphere. What about the southern hemisphere? Did the glaciers from Antarctica also move north?
So Antarctica is an unusual continent in that it's surrounded by the ocean, and it's a special part of the ocean called the Southern Ocean. And it moves water around that. It's the only place on the globe where water can move all the way around Antarctica. And that kind of insulates Antarctica. So the ice sheet can only really kind of go out to the shelf. It can't connect to South America. Now, in terms of other southern ice, Tasmania was glaciated. New Zealand had more glaciers during the last glacial. And, of course, Patagonia had a lot more ice.
And we do see glaciers in even near the equator. Now, how is that possible?
Well, for example, Kilimanjaro is a great example of ice near the equator. And Kilimanjaro is just so high that it's able to kind of creep in under that and have a snow line during the summer, essentially. Right now, the loss of glaciers on Kilimanjaro is fantastically fast, immeasurable on human time scales and with repeat photography. So that's problematic.
And the same is true throughout some of the Andes?
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of ice loss in the high Andes right now.
Do things live on glaciers? Does a glacier have nutrients to support life?
There are a few things. So, for example, in Alaska, I was there. There are a couple. There's what's called snow algae, which is a pink form of algae that lives on the surface of glaciers, so really microscopic plants. And then there are also snow worms, which are these things that kind of burrow through the snow and live on the glacier surface. Those are uncommon, but they do exist.
So when I read some years back that Japanese entrepreneurs were chipping off glacial ice and then bringing it back to be put into drinks, were they getting the purest water possible?
Basically, yeah. It's essentially distilled by the atmosphere. The other neat thing about that really old ice is it's so compressed that it has the air bubbles in it are compressed, and they form this nice little kind of like almost carbonated beverage in a way where the bubbles burst as you drink the old ice.
So is that the problem with the glaciers? Japanese entrepreneurs just took too much ice?
Well, unfortunately, it's just too cheap to make ice in your own freezer. So, yeah.
Now, glaciers appear to be blue. How did they get that color?
Yeah, blue is a natural color of ice. In as much as when it's dense, it's reflective and absorptive bands allow you to see blue. And if you were to look in thin section, for example, you take a part of Antarctica and you slice it very thin and you look through a thin section on a microscope, you see a lot of blue ice. So that's its natural color.
It's ironic that Greenland has so much glacier, has so many glaciers. I guess they call it Greenland because they wanted to compare it to Iceland. Does Iceland have a lot of glaciers as well?
Iceland has a lot of glaciers. It's got the biggest ice cap outside of the polar ice sheets, Vatnajökull, which translates to the water glacier. And so one of the neat things about Iceland is that during what we call the hypsothermal, the altithermal, during Roman times when that culture was blooming, Iceland didn't have a lot of ice. It had very little ice because the climate was so warm. So
it also has a lot of thermal action, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So what are called Jökulalps, or glacier jumps, essentially, are come from Iceland, that term, and there are volcanoes underneath the ice. And when they melt the ice, as they erupt, they form these large outburst floods that are Jokul Alps.
What's it like to try to climb or walk on a glacier?
So glaciers are kind of easy. It depends on what the steepness is. You could be out in your sneakers and be just fine, or in a pair of boots. If it gets much steeper, you need crampons, which are kind of pointy, spiky things that you put on the base of your boots. And in the center of ice sheets, one of the neat things is it's almost like walking on squeaky steel bits because the ice is so cold and the snow is so cold.
I'm going to take a call from, is it Tedla?
Yeah, Tedla, yes.
From Flushing.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I'm really, this is not a science question. Maybe it's a political question. I see many scientists in Northern Hemisphere, in the Greenland, Iceland, and south part of the world doing research. Is this really a no man's land where everybody can do research, or some of the glacier land are just not controlled by any power? Can he explain to me how is the political situation of controlling this part of the world, please?
Thank you for calling.
So all of the glaciers are controlled by their sovereign entities. For example, Alaska, the U.S. controls those, and specifically the Alaska resources or wherever they are in those national forests. Greenland has a special designation. It's a protectorate of Denmark. So it's not a free-for-all in Greenland. It's a sovereign part of Denmark. Antarctica is different. Antarctica is governed by the Antarctic Treaty signed in 1959, and it creates Antarctica as a kind of a scientific playground where the resources are not to be used until all signatories agree on that. So in a way, Antarctica kind of is a free-for-all, but there are specific rules governing the protection of Antarctica.
What happens when an area is contested, like Kashmir?
So there's the highest battlefield is across a glacier between Pakistan and India. Unfortunately, that's subject to geopolitical complications of India and Pakistan. Now there are claims to Antarctica. So for example, Chile and Argentina want to claim to essentially the overlapping parts of Antarctica. And luckily, countries like the U.S. and the U.K. were there to just say, look, the Antarctic Treaty essentially says this is a scientific playground. The resources are not to be used, and defer any conflicts.
And then I'd imagine in the borders between Finland, Norway, and Sweden, we just draw an imaginary line down the glacier and say, okay, this is Finland and this is Sweden?
Yeah, that's right. And as these glaciers—
It's the same glacier.
It's the same glacier, but as these glaciers melt and where the water resources go is an ongoing kind of negotiation between those countries.
My guest is Timothy T. Kreitz.
Kreitz, yes.
C-R-E-Y-T-S. He's a glaciologist with the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. And we're going to take a little break. We invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Stay with us for more on this Please Explain look at glaciers. Well, we are back with our own Science Friday in effect. Timothy T. Kreitz, he's a glaciologist with the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. And we are talking about glaciers. Glaciers, it's hard to say that. I don't want to confuse it with the people who make glass.
Yeah,
glaciers.
And glaciers, yeah.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Mark from Greenpoint, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Great show. My question revolves around the use of glaciers as they're melting and changing the salinity of the oceans and threatening calcium carbonate life. Would it be economically feasible to take chunks of glacier for countries that are in need of water, say like Saudi Arabia, and they could just tow glaciers across the ocean, how much of the glacier would be left?
Could we do this for California, which is going through a serious drought?
Or even California, correct. Yep. I mean, it seems like it's melting anyway, and if it is, why not try to take advantage of
speed up the process. What the heck?
Yeah, well, it's a very altruistic thought, and I sympathize with it. It was people had actually priced this out as to how to do that, and it turns out to be not feasible in terms of just, say, taking an iceberg from Antarctica, getting some tow lines and dragging it to California or Saudi Arabia. It's better to actually spend that money probably, I'm speaking from a different hat, I'm not the glaciologist, but on desalinization or some other technology.
Is it possible to describe the natural purpose of glaciers, how they fit within the world's cryosphere?
Wow, that's almost a philosophical question.
Yeah.
I mean,
they are supplying us with fresh water, but I'm not sure that when Earth was formed that that was the purpose of glaciers.
Well, I guess I think about glaciers as kind of occupying this cold regime. So whenever the Earth plunges into a cold state, glaciers essentially take the water from the ocean and they store it on land. So that's what they do.
But they desalinate?
Oh, definitely. The water in glaciers is fresh. And one of the other things, like, for example, Greenland does, is it actually deflects the air currents, the climate, and allows the warm water to circulate up along the coast of Europe. So there's actually a winds effect associated with the ice sheets. And that changes.
That's what keeps Britain warmer, for example. It allows the water to circulate from Bermuda all the way up there.
That's a part of it, but it's also just actually directing the air currents as well, just from this large mass of ice sitting there with a high pressure system on it in the summertime. Yeah.
What is calving?
Calving is when we have icebergs that break off at the front of glaciers and ice sheets, and essentially bergs spall off and we get bergy bits that form in the fjords and the ocean.
And would one of those things have brought down the Titanic, for example?
The suspicion is that one from Jakobshavn, which is that fastest flowing outlet glacier in Greenland, actually floated down and took out the Titanic. So yes, it was most likely a Greenland iceberg.
A listener, Chet from Manhattan, asks, if there's oil underneath glaciers in the North Pole that is of interest to the United States and Russia.
So the North Pole is under the ocean, but this raises a good question, is what happens when we have resources underneath an ice sheet? And Greenland is governed by Denmark, but large swaths of Antarctica are potentially oil-bearing. As well as mineral bearing. The other half of the essentially the South African mineral belts are in Antarctica. So these are kind of questions that essentially politicians need to deal with.
So before we start going to the moon to mine things or Mars, we have to work out whether we want to do anything to Antarctica and change its environment. We're already changing its environment, aren't we? Penguins are dying off because of what's happening to the glaciers there?
Well, so what's happening is that the global oceans are warming, and the easiest way to distribute that heat is, in a way, to send it south. And so that's what the ocean is doing. And that's melting at the front of glaciers and in front of the outlet glaciers in Antarctica. So, yes.
Amund in Inwood asks, how are hanging glaciers formed, like the one that exists on top of K2?
Hanging glaciers are mountaintop glaciers that are perched on the top. And essentially, they form the same way every other glacier does, is that we have enough snow accumulation that it compacts and compresses the snow to form glacier ice. And then that ice flows down. In this case, it terminates into a valley and just hangs into that valley. So, yeah, very similar, but a very unique and pretty geomorphologic feature.
And there are crevasses, aren't there?
Yes. When you have ice hanging over cliffs, they're generally what we say is it exceeds the strength of ice. So it starts fracturing, and then we get these large crevasses that many of you have seen in movies or television with climbers.
Well, so when you're climbing K2 or Mount Everest, are you climbing a mountain or are you climbing a glacier?
Well, you're climbing a mountain. The the mass of rock itself is a mountain, but the glaciers are flowing down the mountain, and they're often in the lowest lying spots, so they wind up being the easiest traverse routes to the summit.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Caitlin, hi, you're on the air. Caitlin from Asbury Park.
Oh, hi. How are you? Thanks a lot for your show.
Well, what do you want to talk about?
I'm calling because I'm wondering about the Greenland ice sheet melting and affecting the stratification of the Gulf Stream and the ocean conveyor belt. That seems really important.
Right. You made a little reference to this earlier, but can you go into more detail?
As we freshen the ocean, we change its density.
It becomes less senile. Saline, doesn't it?
It becomes less senile, too, ironically. what happens is it becomes less saline, and so the freshwater essentially floats on the saline ocean water, and that changes the ocean circulation. And so, yes, it will affect the ocean conveyor belt. Is it fast enough? Maybe not. I think the real effects are going to be in sea level rise and the rates of sea level rise that we see here in the New York area and New Jersey. Obviously, Sandy had a large effect. I think is the R tunnel is still closed going from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And if we have sea level rise, we essentially get higher storm surge. And so that will be a long-term problem for the New York area.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Yvonne from Park Slope, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had a question about something I'd heard quite a while back, that glacial ice was accumulating the radiation from testing and leaks from power plants and that kind of thing, and that as long as it stays frozen, it's not bothering us, but may be released if the ice melts. Could your guest comment on that, please?
Yes. Generally, the glacier ice, when the snowfall falls on the glacier, then there is the radiation of the atmosphere is caught in that snowfall. So if we have any nuclear fallout, for example, that would show up on the glaciers and ice sheets. Generally, the tritium bomb signal is very clear in the ice cores when there's a change in the isotopic signature of the ice. Most of the glacier ice, and in fact, I would say greater than 99%, is so pure that is not a hazard to humans.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next call is from one of New York's most prominent art galleries, the Sean Kelly Gallery. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air. Is this a performance piece that we're about to experience?
In this particular case, Leonard, no. We just wanted to extend an invitation to you, to Tim, and your listeners. As luck would have it, one of our artists, a Berlin-based photographer, Frank Thiel, currently has an exhibition at the gallery of large-scale photographs of Patagonian glaciers. And they're quite beautiful and might be something that your listeners might enjoy coming to see. So we invite anyone to come down and take a look.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to come.
Terrific.
Thank you so much. Were you startled when you saw Al Gore's film, or was that something you already were quite familiar with?
I was quite familiar with Al Gore's film. I think perhaps the more startling one was Changing Ice because of the repeat photography in there. And there's even in those images, there is still science to be done that we could use to make essentially 3D models of the ice and understand how it's melting.
Robert from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air. Hello, Robert.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, you're on, right?
Yes.
Hi. Question is, due to the desalination of the ocean and the Gulf and where the Gulf Stream comes up, the last time that the conveyor belt stopped on account of that, because there was no continuation, there was an ice age, and it started in around Great Britain and around in Scandinavia. Would that be happening in the next 100 years if the melt continues to get fresh water up there and kills the conveyor belt?
The real key here is that when we melt the ice sheet this time, what we're also doing is we're warming the atmosphere, and we're warming the atmosphere at a greater rate than we'd be cooling the North Atlantic. So the real threat is not the change in the conveyor belt. It's the actual amount of water we're putting into the ocean.
Thank you for your call. Our next caller is Steve from Williamsburg. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Question is about the permafrost.
as it melts, it's going to release methane gas, which I guess is from the accumulation of all the flora and fauna over the millennium. Are there any emerging technologies that you can foresee that might be able to recapture the methane as it does bubble up from the permafrost?
So, yes, there are several oil companies that are working on that to try to understand how to capture the methane and develop essentially economic strategies for that. And permafrost degradation will be a big problem going forward into the future.
Thank you for your call. If you were testifying before Congress today, and one of the climate change deniers was questioning you, what would you say?
One of the things about the ice sheets or the climate system we look at is we don't look at one particular record. We look at all records en masse, and we try to determine what's happening where and what rates. And it's generally, while it's not democratic, it's pretty close to democratic. And by and large, many of the records are saying the climate is changing and we're the result of it. Or we're not the result of it, we're the cause of it. The results are yet to be determined.
Do we know why some glaciers move faster than others? The Kataya Glacier in Pakistan is the fastest. In 1953, it raced more than 7.5 miles in 3 months.
Yeah, that special glacier is called a surging glacier or a galloping glacier. They spend several years in stasis, and then they surge forward. And these are special processes associated with the difference in the snowfall rates relative to the resistance holding the glacier back. And when the snowfall rate allows the weight of the glacier to exceed that resistance, then it flows down.
My great thanks to Timothy T. Kreitz, who's a glaciologist with the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, for being our guest today on Please Explain, our look at glaciers. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Leonard.